Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A controversial Stand Your Ground bill made its way through the Ohio House last week. Before the vote, a small group of protesters began singing and then chanting as they were escorted out of the chamber. Critics believe the bill would make incidents like the one in Florida that ended with the death of teenager Trayvon Martin more common in Ohio. Here's what Republican State Representative Terry Johnson said about the bill that he sponsored.
Those who say that this change will encourage people to take up vigilantism are flat out wrong. Despite this change, Ohio will still be one of the hardest states in the union to prove self-defense in a court of law. That's because our burden of proof for demonstrating self-defense is so much higher than in most states.
Joining us now to clarify what's in the bill, what comes next, is Jim Siegel, State House reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So most people associate the idea of Stand Your Ground with the shooting death of Trayvon Martin in Florida last year. How does the Ohio legislation compare with Florida?
Well, it's not quite the same. The supporters of this bill, which is House Bill 203, have tried to say this is not a Stand Your Ground bill because it's not the same as Florida. But I think many would argue it is a Stand Your Ground bill. It's just not exactly the same as Florida. I do think there's probably some, and I know that I think you have Ken Hansa coming on later. He's done a lot more research on this than I have and can explain it a little more than I can. But I know that there are some other requirements in Ohio in terms of having to prove that you did act in self-defense, I think, maybe than Florida has. And the argument that, I don't think it's not a real crystal clear comparison when you say, if you change Ohio's law, we can have an issue like, the Trayvon Martin shooting. However, it is going to remove the so-called duty to retreat in Ohio, which basically has been kind of missing, and it's being interpreted differently by those who support the bill and those who oppose it. And those who oppose it, I'm including the prosecutors, the police chiefs, the police officers, the FOP in the state. Basically, the supporters say, look, there's no reason for this to be in the law. There's no reason that we should have to worry about retreating when we're facing some kind of a deadly confrontation. And right now in Ohio, you do not have a duty to retreat if you're in your home or if you're in your vehicle. However, that duty to retreat does apply elsewhere. But there's been a lot of, I've heard scenarios brought up by the supporters saying, oh, if I have a gun held to my head and I'm holding my child, how am I expected to turn around and try to run away? Well, prosecutors, police, I've talked to not only the Prosecuting Attorneys Association, I've talked to Ron O'Brien, the Franklin County prosecutor, about this. They just say that's just not the way the law reads. If you're being threatened by a dangerous weapon of some kind, or there's a situation where your life is in danger because of an attacker of some kind, you absolutely have the right to defend yourself and use deadly force to do so. What the duty to retreat basically says is, according to the prosecutors that I've talked to, is that, look, you can't, if you can't escalate the situation that may be beyond what it would have normally needed to be. If somebody is, coming at you and doesn't appear to be armed, you do have a duty to not, pull out your gun and confront him immediately. The law says you should have to back off and at least make an attempt to not escalate the situation. Ron O'Brien told me that there's also a situation where, let's say the two of you and somebody else get into a fist fight and, regardless of who started it, and you've clearly won. I mean, you've beaten him down. The duty to retreat, it basically says you can't continue to bash his head into the concrete until he's dead. You have to back off, and before the guy dies.
And this means that the duty of retreat would no longer be the law of the land.
Right. That would take that out. There's still other elements of self-defense still in state law, and that's where supporters say it is different than Florida. However, there is a concern among prosecutors and police that this will allow situations that may not otherwise have escalated to deadly force to do so. And their big argument is, what are we changing this for? Why? What is the problem with the current law? They no one is pointing to specific examples of where the current self-defense law has led to inappropriate convictions, and that there's people sitting in prison right now, even though they actually were just defending themselves because somehow this duty to retreat was brought in, and they ended up getting prison time.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking about the Stand Your Ground legislation that's pending in the Ohio General Assembly. It's made its way through the Ohio House. It's now headed to the state Senate. We don't know how the governor's going to handle it. We're not sure how the Senate's going to handle it, but we're going to talk to my guest, Jim Siegel, State House reporter at the Columbus Dispatch, about that and more. If you want to join the conversation, you're welcome. But when you do call, tell our screener whether you are for or against the Stand Your Ground legislation before you tell her anything else. Jim Siegel, the supporters say that the bill, among other things, is designed to cut red tape. What kind of red tape are we talking about here?
I'm not sure.
I guess it's in the eye of the beholder.
I guess, well, I mean, cutting red tape, if you think that the 12 hours of training required to get a concealed carry license is unnecessary red tape, then that's being cut. That's being reduced down to 4 hours.
Okay.
Supporters say 12 hours just is not necessary. That 12 hours right now also includes 2 hours of live range time. So you have to spend 2 of those hours actually shooting the gun on a range. That would be, like I said, cut to 4. The range time is not eliminated. However, I don't know that it specifies anymore
how much
you have to do. There are some other provisions, such as, you know, criminal background checks. You get put into this new national system for background checks, and that will kind of not only will it ensure that if you can get a concealed carry license, you don't have anything in your criminal past that disqualifies you, but it also would automatically give you a background check for the purchase of a gun too. So you could kind of avoid doing that a second time. So there are some things here that the supporters say will make it easier to and less burdensome to get a concealed carry license, perhaps to get a gun as well.
It would expand recognition of Ohio's concealed carry permits to other states. Some say that means that Ohio would be recognizing laws from other states that perhaps may be weaker or stronger, one way or the other. But how would that work? Do they know? Does it say in the legislation?
Well, it basically says that any state that recognizes our concealed carry licenses, we would recognize theirs. I'm trying to remember the exact number. Again, Ken Hansen would know this off the top of his head.
Other states?
But yeah.
I want to say 17 or 21.
I was going to say 17 is the number I'm thinking of,
yeah.
That we do not recognize right now. And most of those, almost all of them, is because they have training requirements that do not stack up to ours. They have no training requirements. They have very limited training requirements. Their background checks aren't as stringent as ours. So that's why. But if this goes into effect, we will start recognizing concealed carry licenses from those states. Again, that's an issue that police in particular have expressed concern about, because they just, you know, they say this will allow people to carry guns in Ohio that have that would not be able to otherwise get a concealed carry license if they lived here.
Then there's a local government component that would require local governments that are taken to court over their local laws regarding local gun laws, that would require them to pay the costs of the litigants.
Well, the current law requires attorney fees, but this is kind of an unusual situation. I actually have a story in the paper today about mm-hmm. this. Basically, the concern that the gun groups have, particularly some that have been suing some cities over their local ordinances, say is that, okay, they file the lawsuit, they challenge this whatever gun law. Let's say it's a ban of guns in parks, which right now cities are not allowed to basically pass gun laws that are stricter than the state law.
Right.
So let's say a city has that on the books and they challenge it. What their concern is that they challenge it, and then a couple weeks later, a month later, whatever, the city then repeals that law before it ever really goes to court. Well, the argument among the gun groups is, you know, that means we've had to pay an attorney, we've had to go through the cost of filing this lawsuit, and now because you've repealed it before we actually got a verdict or a judgment, then we don't get our attorney fees. So what they're trying to do is ensure that when cities do actually repeal these laws, that they do get some compensation. And the way it's written right now is from the moment you file the challenge to the moment that they actually repeal it, that would be a $100 a day, basically civil penalty against the city that would be paid to the complainant in this case. Like I said, it's unusual. I don't know that I've seen a situation like that before. The cities are arguing, look, not first of all, you're just here's yet another bill that's going to take money away from us. And then secondly, they're saying, look, sometimes a lot of these laws that are maybe still be on the books aren't really being enforced anymore. We understand we're not allowed to do these things for the most part. I mean, there may be some rogue villages and cities out there that try to push the limit, but for the most part, they understand they can't enforce these laws. So what they do is they say, look, these are on the books. Nobody's taking them off. We just quit enforcing them. They come in, they sue. We say, oh, okay, well, we'll go ahead and repeal. But they may not. Their council may not meet for 2 weeks, 4 weeks. It may take three readings to repeal the law. They may take several. You know, it may take 3 months to actually get it off the books. So there's 3 months worth of $100 daily fines that they'll end up paying. So that's where the cities have a concern about that. It's a unique situation. I'm not sure I've seen this kind of thing before, and it'll be curious to see if the Senate makes any changes there.
So what is the next step for the bill? It's passed the House. How did it do in the House? Was it largely along party lines, or how do you describe the vote?
It was largely along party lines in that Republicans were very much in favor of it. The Democrats were more split. And this is not unusual in the legislature. Some of the, particularly the more rural Democrats, tend to be more in favor of gun legislation. I'm not sure. And you talk to many of them privately, and they'll tell you that, you know, they support it, but it's not like they're running out there trying to get these things passed. It's mainly a matter of if they don't support it, they're in for a world of headaches in the back in their district. It's just easier to vote yes and avoid all that trouble. I think there were 27 no votes or something of that nature. I don't have my notes in front of me, but yeah, it passed pretty strongly. Good 2-1 at least, maybe.
Is this
more
one of those issues when it comes to the Republicans that if you vote the wrong way, it could lead to a primary challenge?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, it could. Although, you know, it's primary challenges can be drummed up for all kinds of reasons. But the NRA has long been a powerful lobbying force in the State House. It's somewhat of the money, but it's also just their supporters are very active and very vocal. That's the thing I've noticed covering this issue for many years, is that, you know, whereas, you know, it, you know, you may do a poll and find that these issues aren't exactly overwhelmingly supported by the public in general,
right.
The loudest people are, you know, they the most passionate people tend to be the supporters. It's the people who don't want it. They just kind of, it's more of less, they shrug their shoulders and say, well, I don't think I need that. But they don't really go to the State House as much to actually protest the bills.
Tell us about Terry Johnson. He's a Republican state rep who sponsored the bill. Is he from a rural area? Can you tell us a little bit about him?
He is. He's from the, I'm trying to remember where he's from. He's from Southwest Ohio, but I can't remember. I'm trying to remember. Marietta. I want to say Marietta.
Okay.
Or McDermott.
McDermott. Yeah.
That's it. He's a doctor. He's involved in, he's long been in interest in the gun issue. He's very, you know, very pro Second Amendment.
It's a long-time issue for
him. Yeah, this is very consistent for him.
And then how's this expected to fare in the Senate? Basically the way it did in the House, it moved through the House very, very quickly, right?
Yes.
Considering how little has gotten done in the last year.
I don't know if it moved very quickly, but it definitely had a nice pace to it. I mean, they didn't sit back and let it sit too long.
Mm-hmm.
And in these issues, I mean, frankly, they could get all the testimony in and get the, you know, get all the sides to weigh in and have their meetings. They don't, you know, everybody knows who's, you know, weighing in on these bills. It's not like we're waiting for some secret group out there to come in that we haven't heard from before. I mean, these gun issues have been debated now for over a dozen years, and so they're very well established. So they can move quickly if that's what the leaders want. And the Senate, I don't know really. I've tried to put in some calls to some folks over there that haven't heard much from them yet in terms of where they are on it. It's you know, I wouldn't be, I'd be surprised if they moved it too quickly. This is a huge bill. I mean, we've talked about some of the issues. I mean, there's another issue in there dealing with whether, you know, when police's ability to stop somebody based on a suspicion if they, if they're carrying a gun. And there's, you know, there's, it's language that's was kind of stuck into the disorderly conduct and inducing a panic statutes that the prosecutors are like, well, we've never seen this kind of thing before, and we're not even sure why it's there or what it's, what they hope to do with it, except that it's going to cause mass confusion among law enforcement, prosecutors, and the courts. So there's a lot to discuss. This is not just a stand your ground bill, although that's getting most of the attention for obvious reasons. But there's a lot of parts to this, and I would be surprised to see the Senate just kind of stamp it and move on. I think they're going to have to take a long look. And there's some folks in the Senate who are very favorable to the police point of view. Senator Jim Hughes from Columbus is a former prosecutor. He will certainly listen quite a bit to what the prosecutors have to say about this. So it should be a good discussion.
And what about the governor? Has he said anything one way or the other yet?
Governor has absolutely refused to weigh in on this one so far.
Okay. We will continue our conversation about the Stand Your Ground measure. It's pending. It just came out of the House. It'll be shipping off to the Senate any day now. My guest right now, Jim Siegel, State House reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Coming up, we're going to have people for and against the measure, so stay with us. If you do call in, tell the screener that you are for or against the measure. 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, House Bill 203 took its first major step toward becoming law when it passed in the House. The bill would make several changes to existing gun laws, including a controversial Stand Your Ground measure. You're familiar with that. That was at the kind of a cornerstone of the issue in the shooting death of Trayvon Martin in Florida. Joining us in the studio is Ken Hansen. He is the legislative chair for the Buckeye Firearms Association. Ken is a general practice attorney in Delaware.
Yes, ma'am.
He is the author of the Ohio Guide to Firearm Laws, now in its fourth edition. And Ken has served as a chief assistant county prosecutor, municipal prosecutor, and a court-appointed counsel in major felony cases. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Ken, tell us about your organization. Who are your members? How big is it? Does it differ in any way with the NRA?
Well, Buckeye Firearms Association, we have several organizations. There's an Ohio Political Action Committee, mm-hmm. and then there's a 501c3 foundation. There's really no membership. It's supporters, financial donations, that sort of thing. The 501c3 concentrates on training, education, that sort of thing. And then the PAC is obviously the political side.
So who does support you financially?
Oh, any number of people. I mean, we've had donations from all 50 states, several different countries, nationally, internationally. It's a broad spectrum.
Does the Buckeye Firearms Association back every aspect of the measure?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And is there anything not in the measure that you wanted in there that you didn't get?
Well, as you know, there's several pro-gun bills pending downtown. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the idea is small bites. If you put everything into one bill, it's just going to become unwieldy and it's just going to die from inertia.
Why is the Stand Your Ground component necessary in Ohio?
Well, when we're talking about a Stand Your Ground component, what we're talking about is removing the duty to physically retreat from the situation, which is a medieval concept. It comes before modern firearms. And when we're talking about Stand Your Ground in Ohio anyway, what we're talking about is removing the duty to physically retreat. You know, in all the testimony we had downtown, even, you know, like Mr. Siegel talked about with Prosecutor Ron O'Brien, you know, of course, if someone's pointing a gun at you, you can't retreat. Well, you know, the Ohio law still is that person has to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that they couldn't retreat. And here in Ohio, we've had courts instruct juries that there's a duty to retreat from a locked jail cell. It's just a provision that makes no sense anymore.
In what way would Ohio remain one of the hardest states in the country to prove self-defense? Can you get into that more specifically? And if the duty to retreat is removed from law, isn't it counterbalanced by making it so difficult to prove self-defense anyway?
Well, it's counterbalanced, but there's also safeguards. To answer your first part of the question, Ohio is the only state that requires the defendant to prove self-defense as an affirmative defense. In the other 49 states, except for a few districts in Louisiana, the prosecution has the burden to prove that the defendant wasn't acting in self-defense. It's a reasonable doubt standard. They have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt they weren't acting in self-defense. And, you know, that's not my opinion. That's, you know, law professors writing articles and things like that. The second part of that is there are still safeguards built in. You don't get to the duty to physically retreat, until you've already proven you're not at fault in creating, prolonging, or escalating the situation and proving that there are reasonable grounds to believe that you were in imminent danger of serious physical harm or death. So those safeguards are still there, and you don't even get down to the duty to physically retreat till you've overcome those first two steps.
Can you put this in terms? I mean, you're a lawyer, and mm-hmm. so it's really, really familiar to you to talk this way. But say I'm somebody, I mean, can you put it in terms that people ordinary people, lay people can understand about a real life situation that this may come to play for them?
Well, I mean, we don't want to put attorneys out of business. If it was easy to understand, we wouldn't have jobs. That's job security, right?
Right.
Yeah. If 203 passed, what a person would have to prove by a preponderance of the evidence, acting in self-defense, that they were not at fault in creating, prolonging, or escalating the situation.
So they didn't start the fight.
They didn't start the fight. Second, they'd have to prove that there were reasonable facts present to justify their belief that they were in fear of imminent serious physical harm or death. So, for instance, you know, we got back to shooting Girl Scouts. You know, that was in the floor debate this week. A 5-year-old, there's no reasonable grounds present.
Cookies at the door, yeah, thing?
Exactly. Okay. You know, that was the speeches on the floor against it. We're going to be shooting Girl Scouts. Nonsense. You know, there's no reasonable grounds present to justify your fear that there was imminent danger.
What is there, what facts are there out there that we know that people have been harmed by the absence of Stand Your Ground law in Ohio, by the, you know, by the reasonable, you know, by retreating?
Mm-hmm.
Is there an example out there in Ohio that stands out for people who support this law?
Well, I mean, the obvious answer is every case there's harm, because in every case that person acting has to prove at their own peril that they could not safely physically retreat from the situation.
But do we have an example of somebody who can say, I didn't shoot, I stood my ground because I thought that I would be harmed otherwise?
Just last week, I think it was here in Columbus, there was a person trying to run away, got shot twice in the back. Media reports. I'll be glad to forward them to you from just in the last week here in Ohio.
And we know that they thought they did it because of they knew what the law was, and they knew if they stood their ground, they would be.
I have no idea what was going through their mind. But the thing you have to understand is, in these situations, you're going through fight, flight, freeze, posture, submit. You're going through adrenal reaction, time dilation, auditory exclusion. You've lost your higher thinking functions, and we're requiring people to go through a multi-step test in their mind to decide, okay, am I able to do this or not, versus my life's in danger, I need to act.
Joining us now by phone to discuss what this might mean for Ohio is Toby Hoover. She is the founder and former director of the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence. Welcome to the show, Toby.
Thank you, Ian.
First, Toby, tell us about the coalition. How big is it? Who are your members?
Oh, our members come from all over the state of Ohio, plus some other states. Their organizations, their different committees, their projects, and their individuals. So it's just a wide spectrum of different kinds of people that are concerned about the violence.
And is there any part of the measure passed last week in the House that you support, that you understand the rationale for and would support?
There actually would be one if I could clarify exactly what's going to happen.
Sure.
They introduced one that would have a national instant criminal background check for people that are getting their licenses to carry weapons. But I'm not sure that they didn't do away with the Ohio part of the check, which they were using before. And if so, they're sort of trading off one database for another database and still not getting everybody. So I don't have the answer to it because it reads a couple different ways. The sponsor of the bill said that the sheriff may do both. The bill looks like it reads that they will do both. So I'm still trying to figure out if they will do both checks. And if they do, that will include a lot of things that we have in our system in Ohio that may not be at the national. And, of course, we pick up with the national background check, we pick up things from other states. So that's a good thing.
I asked Ken Hansen if there was anything in the bill that they wanted, but it wasn't in the bill. And he said, well, there's a lot of other stuff pending at the State House, but you don't put it all in one bill. If you had to pick the thing in the bill that does absolutely had to go, what component of it would it be? What are you working
this
hardest
bill,
to get rid of?
This bill is so complicated that it ought to be against some law to put this many things into a bill. I think the forced reciprocity of giving other states automatic allowance to carry in Ohio and prohibiting the Attorney General from doing his job is probably really one of the most dangerous things in the bill because other states do not have the same kind of training. And so we're kind of saying, gee, we're not going to control who carries in Ohio. We're just going to put it out there to the lowest common denominator and let other states decide the kind of people that, I mean, there are some states that have no training at all. There are some states that do most of their application online. They're, you know, they allow different people to have permits to carry. So it's like opening it up and saying, you know, we'll just take anybody and they can carry in the state of Ohio. That's really a very dangerous thing to do.
And Ken Hansen, there's that, but there's also some language in the in the bill that would reduce the number of hours of training or preparation you would require for the concealed carry permit in the state of Ohio.
Yes.
So can you address Toby Hoover's note that we would be letting in people, giving credence to people with concealed carry permits from other states that have lesser requirements, and at the same time, why have lesser requirements in the state of Ohio? Why lower those standards?
Well, I mean, for instance, Indiana and Pennsylvania, our neighboring states, have no training requirements, and they've had no training requirements for a long time. They have no problems with that. When I travel to a different state, all of my constitutional rights follow me. I have the same right to go to church, the same right to write an op-ed, the same right to be free from search and seizure. The only right that I leave at the border is my right to self-defense. By opening reciprocity, that allows people to travel with their right to self-defense. So from the training standpoint, it's not a problem in the other states. It's a very predictable progression. When they first introduce and pass a law, there's a high training requirement. Then the state realizes this is not a big deal. The training requirement gets reduced, and it's still not a big deal.
Toby Hoover, are you comforted by that?
No, I'm not.
Why not? Can you point to an example of where a lack of training or lesser requirements has led to a problem?
Well, you know, the concealed carry laws in the country vary drastically,
right,
in every single state. But I think, you know, the big thing here is that all we have heard since the beginning of this law back in 2004 is these are the most well-trained law-abiding people in the state that are going to carry. And now, with each session that rolls around, they want to take some of those things that say they are really well-trained. And also in this bill, even law-abiding, that we keep changing those things and saying we'll accept less. And for most of us, and we have to keep in mind that fewer than 5% of the Ohio adult population has their permits or thinks they need to carry a gun all the time. For most of us, we believe that, you know, we have rights too, and that we are not comfortable with the guns being around our families to start with in all kinds of public places. But then when you add to that, we say, well, why don't they want to be trained? Why don't they want to have extra knowledge? Especially, why don't they want to have extra knowledge about when not to shoot? I heard Mr. Hansen earlier describing the stand your ground, and that would be nice if everybody could understand all the affirmative defense like he does. But we have to face facts, And if people read a couple of sentences, what they're going to do is they're going to have, they're just going to be emboldened to escalate any kind of confrontation because they've been told they don't, they can. And so, you know, what we would like to believe everybody understands and what they take from this are two different things. So now we've got people who not only in Ohio, but from other states could be carrying into Ohio with less training. And then we're also sort of giving them permission to change their behavior, to go ahead and take the law into their own hands.
Ken Hansen of the Buckeye Firearms Association, as you think about introducing something like a stand your ground provision in Ohio law, why is it also a good time to lower the requirements and have less training, as is also called for in the bill, when you talk about how people in those situations who are being confronted by danger and have to make those split-second decisions have already lost their higher thinking functions? Wouldn't it be a time to increase the training if you're going to allow a stand-your-ground provision in the law?
Well, I mean, the only one that's saying that they can now escalate these situations and get away with things that they can't get away with now are those who are opposed to the bill. The ones that are in support of the bill are saying, no, I mean, it's still the same standard. It's only that the duty to physically retreat has been removed. And look, if we reduce the training standard, their knowledge requirement is exactly the same. The Ohio Attorney General publishes the Self-Defense Law Handbook, and every concealed carry licensee applying for a license or applying to renew in Ohio must certify that they have read the Attorney General's summary of self-defense laws.
Is that all the training is?
That is all that is required under current training to know what the self-defense laws are, and that is all that would be required under reduced training if 203 passes.
So what changes if 203 passes when it comes to the training then?
The arbitrary number of hours a person must sit in a chair. They still have to go through 2 hours of live fire range training. That hasn't changed. The only thing that has changed is the arbitrary number of hours that they have to sit in a chair.
Why is it called? Why do you use the word arbitrary?
There's no magic to the number 12. I mean, other states have zero. Other states have four. Some states have six. I mean, there's no magic to the number. What it comes down to is conveying a core body of knowledge that we're not training tactical operators. Mm-hmm. We're giving some people some tools to exercise a constitutional right.
You know, I always remember my driver's ed course. They made us sit arbitrarily, I guess, and watch a film of auto accidents over and over and over again. It really had a big impact on me. Do you think anything like that? I mean, is there anything like that in the training now? And to give people the sense of that, I remember them telling us, that car's a 2,000-pound murder weapon. It really had a big impression on me.
And yet, once you turn age 18 in Ohio, you don't have to sit in that chair and watch that
film.
You go in and you take the test. There's no training required to get a driver's license if you're an adult.
So you're saying that that just means it isn't worthwhile to have that kind of training, or?
It's not worthwhile to make it a barrier to entry. The number is arbitrary. Okay. We're still going to have a training requirement. They're still going to be sitting in chairs. They're still going to be standing on a range line shooting a gun.
All right. Well, we're going to continue our conversation with Ken Hansen, legislative chair for the Buckeye Firearms Association, and by phone, Toby Hoover, founder and former director of the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence, and Jim Siegel, still with us, State House reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This hour, we've been discussing a new gun legislation that's been making its way through the State House. Among other things, would echo Florida's and 17 or 16 other states' Stand Your Ground legislation. It's familiar to many of us by way of the deadly shooting of Trayvon Martin in Florida. you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Beth in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Beth. You oppose the legislation, and it's you're worried about, you have concerns about discriminatory problems.
Well, there's a history of discriminatory problems with Stand Your Ground, but the whole, the way that it just went flying through Congress.
Through the State House, okay.
Through the State House.
Well, through the Ohio House. It still has to go to the Senate.
Right, and then just like, it just scares me because it's just part of that whole movement of less government is better. We can handle this ourselves. And, you know, a lot of people just aren't in their right minds when shootings occur. And it's just going to give more people more opportunities to say, hey, I was standing my ground.
Okay.
When the Trayvon Martin case happened, there was a woman with her 14-year-old son. They were at their boat dock. Somebody was stealing their boat from their slip. So she had her 14-year-old kid shoot the guy who was stealing the boat because it was under Stand Your Ground.
Okay. This is a Florida case?
Yep.
Okay. All right. Okay. Thanks a lot for the call.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. If anyone else has a call, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. John in Marysville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, and
right. Yep.
I'm sorry. Yes, my question is, does the Stand Your Ground law, does it take into account any other weapons other than guns? So in other words, maybe a specific question would be, if my weapon of choice is a machete, am I protected under this ground to use a machete in self-defense?
Okay, let's, I guess, Ken Hansen of the Buckeye Firearms Association.
John, thanks for the call. What we're talking about with duty to physically retreat is the use of any lethal force. So whether it's a knife, whether it's a gun, a shotgun, a machete, an airstrike, that's the only time the duty to physically retreat comes up. So lethal force is lethal force no matter what the implement is.
This isn't just a gun law.
Correct.
Let's talk a little bit about, well, as much as we have to, a big concern, Jim Siegel, you wrote about it this morning in the Dispatch about the concern that local governments have about the provision in the bill that would require governments to cover expenses in the case of a lawsuit when there is a something on their books that hasn't been repealed yet.
Yes. One of the provisions is against the municipalities that continue to have gun control laws on their books. The Ohio Supreme Court has twice now ruled that revised code 9.68 is constitutional. And that basically operates as it operates as a preemption against local ordinances. The municipalities are saying, well, you know, we don't enforce these laws. It's going to ambush us or whatever. It's within your control. Take them off the books. There's no reason to leave them on the books if you're not enforcing them. I mean, it still has a chilling effect on the exercise of the right.
Well, there's lots of laws that are left on the books all over the place. Sometimes people have joke books out about them.
Mm-hmm.
But why these? Are they being challenged someplace because they're being enforced, or are people just challenging them because they're there?
It's very little comfort to a person exercising a right that one administration has said we're not enforcing it. There's been an election. Okay, is the new administration enforcing it or not? You know, they could have a law on the books saying, there's no freedom of the press. We all know that's unconstitutional, but we're going to leave it on the books because we're not enforcing it. It has a chilling impact on the exercise of the right. And if they know they can't enforce these laws, they need to take them off the books.
Toby Hoover, any strong feelings about that?
Well, I had strong feelings about 9.68 to start with when they preempted over 80 ordinances in over 20 cities in the state of Ohio that thought they were speaking for their communities.
Mm-hmm.
But like you say, now there are some of them out there that they're still on the books. Nobody has been enforcing them. This is seems to be an exercise that some of the gun people and the promoters of this have done to cities just to see what kind of trouble that they can cause, even if the city is trying to find a remedy or to look at, well, what else could we do? And this bill says they will fine them $100 a day. And the other thing they have done is show up in numbers in parks to show the community that they can, because it's supposedly their right. And we maintain that we all have a right. We have a right to not be in favor of that, and we have a right to be free from gun violence. And that's not taken into account at all. They just want to go out and sort of flex their muscles, if you will, and carry their guns wherever they please. And so they've been instigating it, and now they want to pass something that after they instigate it, if the city doesn't move fast enough, they'll fine them on a per-day basis.
Okay, let's go to Matt in Westerville. Matt, you support the legislation, but you have concerns about the training component. Tell us what you're thinking.
Certainly. To my knowledge, the requirement before was to have 12 hours of training, whatever that training would be comprised of. The new requirement is going to take that down to 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
My concern would be, why is it based on time at all instead of proficiency with the weapon? If I do 4 hours, 12 hours, or 24 hours of training, and I still can't hit the broadside of a barn, why should I have a concealed carry?
Ken Hansen, can you talk about that?
Honestly, if they offered tomorrow anyone who can pass the OPATA 1 handgun qualification class, you don't require any training, people jump all over that because it's not a hard qualification. If we could just test out a training, I'm sure people would be in support of that.
Well, what about the time of 12 hours, whatever, in addition to showing proficiency?
Well, I mean, again, the proficiency is what you do with the gun. So if I've demonstrated on the range, I can pass an objective test. I've demonstrated my proficiency. I've read the law book prepared by the Attorney General. Why couldn't I say at that point I should be able to test out a training?
When you read the law book, do you have to take a test to show you?
No.
Okay. I'm sorry. Matt, does that answer your question?
I suppose it does. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Vinny in Columbus, you're neutral on the topic. What is your question?
So I'm a current concealed carry permit holder, and I heard Ken's comment earlier about the reciprocity between other states that have concealed carry permits allowed. And one of the best things that I thought through the training process was going through the classroom training and specifically listening to a lawyer come in and talk to us about, even if you do everything that the law outlines, things can still go wrong. And I thought that classroom training and that discussion with the lawyer specifically was probably one of the best things about the preparation for going to get the permit. Because similar to how real estate agents learn how not to get sued in real estate school, as a permit carrier, you want to know what do you have to do in the scenario in which you are presented with threats against your life. So I think for us in Ohio to have that is critical. And if other states don't require that, then it doesn't meet the standard that Ohio's put together to say that the citizens that carry should know how to handle a firearm and the legal implications of that firearm. So, you know, I think we have a good standard, and I would be weary of allowing other states that don't have that same standard to let those people bring guns into our state.
Toby Hoover, agree? I mean, is that where you're coming from?
Yeah, exactly. I would only add to that that I think part of the training definitely ought to be about, as he's inferring, that it ought to be about where you shouldn't be carrying. There are prohibited places. And a strong emphasis on the fact that, you know, what is a time, what are the circumstances when you can really use this self-defense? When this bill was passing back in 2004, I had people at the State House standing there waiting to go into hearings that would tell me that, well, if I come home and I see someone is in my house stealing my TV, I'm going in with my gun drawn. And no matter how many times you try to tell those people, this isn't about material things. This is about danger to yourself. If you're doing self-defense, they don't even hear you. So I much stronger emphasis on the fact that it's not about things, it's about people.
Ken Hansen, what about what Vinny said, that he's a concealed carry permit holder, and he thought that the training was critical?
Well, what I would tell Vinny is there's no requirement in Ohio that an attorney come in and talk to the class.
But in his case, they did have one.
In his case, he did, and I talked to over 4,000 students a year. I usually spend 6 to 7 hours on a weekend in classes. That's not a requirement. It won't be a requirement under 203. It's not a requirement now. There's nothing stopping you from getting that training if that's what you want to get. You can still get that training if 203 passes. What we have now is a pamphlet prepared by the Attorney General's office that has information in there like you can't use deadly force to protect property.
Well, do you think that training by having a lawyer come in and tell you and talk, a human being coming in to talk to you is different? Different people learn differently.
Mm-hmm.
Some people don't learn well from just reading a pamphlet. Some people learn better from hearing somebody talk to them about it, where they can do a give and take and answer questions. Do you think that wouldn't be of value?
Oh, I wouldn't be able to say it's not of value because the instructors pay me to come in. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they see it as a value to their class. That's not to say that someone in the class isn't sitting there doing something on their iPad, you know, whatever, reading the newspaper, falling asleep.
Right.
They choose to take as much information as they want to take. We can't cram it into them.
Okay. All right, Vinny, thanks for your call. Kelly in Delaware County, you are for the law, but you want to talk about the training as well. You're
yes.
on the air. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I agree with Matt. I think proficiency is so important. I would like to see some sort of a logbook format that once you get your CCW, that you need to continue to go out to the range on a regular basis and get your logbook stamped. And, you know, have a certain amount of hours on the range every year in order to keep the CCW active. Because a couple of hours, you know, practicing shooting on a target is simply not enough to be able to work with a weapon safely.
Ken Hansen?
Kelly, what I would tell you is first, we're talking about the exercise of a constitutional right. We don't require training to go to church. We don't require voter education before you can vote. We don't require them to certify that they understand the candidates and their positions. We're talking about the exercise of a constitutional right. The recurrent training is up to the individual to do as they see fit. And if you look at the statistics in these shootings, the police have far more training, yet in the police shootings, you're always reading about, you know, police fired 50 shots. Shots and three hit the suspect. There was a news report on the way in today. Police fired 2 shots, didn't hit the suspect. Training is one part of competency. It is not the only part of competency. And no one's ever going to be able to tell how someone's going to perform when under stress.
All right, Kelly. Toby Hoover, any thoughts about that?
Well, I think that, you know, Ken has mentioned a number of times about what happens to you when you're under the stress and when something is really happening versus just in a class or talking about it. I'm always for, you know, more training. I think Kelly's got a good idea because nobody stays the same. People change. People forget. So recurring training would be really good.
Ken Hansen, law enforcement organizations, including the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association, the Ohio Association of Police Chiefs, both oppose the measure. They say there's no need for it and that they have no vested interest in prosecuting a legitimate self-defense. So they're saying it's not needed.
Well, I have great respect for the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association, Buckeye State Sheriff's Association. We certainly listen to their input when it's provided. That doesn't mean that we don't agree to disagree on some provisions. As far as some of the other law enforcement groups downtown, they've burned their credibility so bad with dire predictions in the past that people just don't listen to them anymore.
Jim Siegel?
And actually, I wanted to ask Toby about this, and I would be curious to hear Toby and Ken discuss this quickly. It's you know, we always hear about the Trayvon Martin and relates to Stand Your Ground. But when I heard Toby testify, she mentioned that it wasn't about the actual shooting part of it that was to Stand Your Ground. I think she talked about it, you know, the Stand Your Ground portion occurred before that. And I was hoping maybe she could describe that in a little bit.
Yeah, and Toby, we got about 60 seconds, so there you go. No pressure.
Okay. It falls in line with what we think emboldens people, changes behavior, makes them think that they can take the law into their own hands. George Zimmerman, it applies to Stand Your Ground when he got out of the truck. He was a permit carrier. He was told not to get out of the truck. He did so anyway. He sort of pursued it because he thought he could. After he was being beat upon and he was defending himself, that was the self-defense part of it.
It wasn't a Stand Your Ground issue at that point. And
no.
Ken Hansen, we have just about 30 seconds.
Yeah, it's important to understand that if that Zimmerman case had happened in Ohio, there's nothing that would have changed. There's nothing that empowers you or prohibits you from following someone. Where he would have been in trouble in Ohio, and where he will still be in trouble in Ohio if two or three passes, is the question of, is he at fault? Did it create, prolong, or escalate the situation? That would be a problem before and after 203 here in Ohio, whereas it wasn't in Florida. That question would arise in Ohio. It doesn't in Florida.
Ken Hansen and Toby Hoover, thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it. And you too, Jim Siegel. Thanks. Toby Hoover's from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence, and Ken Hansen's with the Buckeye Firearms Association. Jim Siegel with Columbus Dispatch. Thanks for listening. All Sides with Ann Fisher, 89.7 NPR News.